And on RN, it's hello from David Rutledge and welcome to this week's edition of Encounter. This year marks two grim anniversaries. 100 years since the outbreak of World War I and 75 years since the outbreak of World War II. Many historians believe that these two wars are actually better understood as one long war with a break in the middle. And today we'll be focusing on Germany and how the history of anti-Semitism can be understood in relation to this dark period of the 20th century. It's a period marked by the influence of the Christian churches in Germany, and it's a period that takes us inexorably to the historical climax of anti-Semitism, the so-called final solution of the Nazis. The program's produced by Florence Sperling.
The lamplighters were going through the streets outside. The Foreign Secretary, standing in the window, said, "The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime."
The Jewish imperative of remembrance, which is one of the key issues of Jewish identity, the exhibition's frame is exactly this relationship of remembrance in times when nothing is there anymore of what you should remember.
Hello, I'm Florence Sperling, and that was Celie Kugelman, Program Director and Vice Director of the Jewish Museum in Berlin. She's speaking in the museum about their recent exhibition, A Time for Everything, Rituals Against Forgetting. Professor Stephanie Schuler-Springorum is the director of the Institute for Research on Antisemitism at the Technical University in Berlin. Church-synagogue conflict is evident in the Christian Bible. Here we take up the history of Christian-Jewish relations in the 16th century with the Protestant Reformation in Germany.
What happens in the Protestant Revolution or Reformation, so to speak, is that anti-Semitism was from the beginning also part of the Protestant faith. It was and is deeply ingrained in the Catholic dogma or Catholic Church. And then with the Reformation, it became part of Protestantism as well. And as Protestantism spread over Germany and Europe, it became part of that part of Christianity as well.
We have to remember that in the course of European history, since the crucifixion, the church fathers curiously blamed the entire Jewish race for the alleged murder of Christ, and this lasted down until recent times.
The Reverend Dr. John Moses is an Anglican priest who studied in Germany. He taught history at the University of Queensland from 1965 to 1994, and he's the author of several books and articles on German and Australian history. He's currently professorial fellow at Charles Sturt University.
And even Dietrich Bonhoeffer initially believed, as a traditional German Lutheran, that the Jews were a people both loved and punished by God. He came to revise his former position and to demonstrate that it was absurd to believe that God was punishing the Jews.
The long history of anti-Semitism in Europe found new contexts after the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. There was also for Germany the Franco-Prussian War, and after it the unification in 1871 of German states under Bismarck. How were Jewish communities affected by these changes? Professor Stephanie Schuler-Springorum.
It was like ambivalent experience because on the one hand you had this process of political emancipation, of political rights, which they were then taken back and forth, and it was discussions in the different German states and even in Prussia it was discussed back and forth. And at the same time in the 19th century we have the process of huge and rapid social change and upwardly mobile in the sense that the Jews in Germany who around 1800 had been mainly poor and not even middle class, I mean really poor peddlers and so on, that this Jewish population moved into the middle class because some of the legal impediments were taken away and because of the dynamic economic development in Germany. On the one hand they experienced a social upward move and on the other they still had a battle against legal discrimination.
After the French Revolution in 1789, Jews were accorded equality before the law when their constitutions were worked out in France and full citizenship. In other words, there was no discrimination on the grounds of their being Jewish. Now, that didn't happen in Germany until unification under Bismarck in 1871 when they got a federal constitution. Prior to that, in the various principalities, there was a variety of practices regulating the life of Jews within the different principalities, ranging from some who had a very special status of privilege because of their wealth, and there were some families that were in Bavaria, for example, that were virtually noble families. But ranging from that downwards, there were Jews still in ghettos in various parts of the Holy Roman Empire at that time. And so you could speak of a kind of apartheid being applied to Jews up until 1871.
Were the churches still persisting in a basic hostility towards Jews who had not converted to Christianity?
Yeah, I think that that is correct. The Jews were accorded equality under the Constitution, and all legal disabilities had been abolished, so they had full citizenship rights, but that didn't mean the end of social discrimination. That became even worse, if anything, in some regions, and the churches continued to discriminate against Jews, demand that they be baptized, and then they would be acceptable for the most part. But during the Wilhelmine Empire, perhaps the most striking element of discrimination against the Jews was that the Prussian army made it virtually impossible for a Jew to enter the officer class, although there were some exceptions, such as the famous industrialist Walter Rathenau prior to the First World War, but that didn't happen very often. It happened during the war when they suffered a shortage of officers, and there were some outstanding examples of officers of Jewish background.
Coming from Hegel, the idea that the state, and the German state in particular, is the instrument of God on earth, can you speak about that?
The German theologians and historians had that particular view derived from the philosophy of Hegel and reinforced by the history teaching of the Prussian school of historians. They claim to be able to see the will of God working through the Prussian-German state. But I would say that not everybody accepted that. Bismarck's unification of Germany was not universally welcomed across all regions and classes. The Iron Chancellor, as he was called, had enforced, if you like, an external union on all the Germanic states, except Austria, of course. But the subjects of the southern German principalities, where there were a majority of Roman Catholics, were initially not entirely happy with the founding of the Reich. For them, unification meant Prussification and the deadening hand of Protestantism. Indeed, historians have written about the need in Germany at that time for what they called the Innere Reichsgründung, in other words, an internal foundation of the Reich, whereby it was meant that they, in particular, needed to persuade the Roman Catholic population to endorse Prussian predominance. So there was much historical, philosophical discussion about whether the 1871 foundation of the Reich was the foreordained will of Almighty God. The pro-Prussians argued this vigorously, and Roman Catholics tended to be critical of it, and of course socialists rejected it entirely. But the main thing was that the Prussian-dominated historical discipline in Germany had a virtual monopoly of education, and that was all that people were getting to hear when they went to universities all over the country.
I'm wondering, in relation to that, is whether the Catholic communities of post-unified Germany were as anti-Semitic as the Protestant community tended to be?
Yes, I think the answer to that, in general, yes, they were. They had difficulty in accepting Jewish subjects within their community, yes. Conversion was demanded, if you like, for more social acceptance.
John Moses, Stephanie Schuler-Springorum again. When the Franco-Prussian War led on then to German unification in 1871, what happened for Jews as Germany became a nation-state and an emerging imperial power?
I think at the beginning, like in after 1871, and many Jews fought on the, you know, on both sides actually, on the German and the French side. At the beginning, it was a great feeling of hope, because most of the German Jews were much in favor of the founding of the Second Reich, as it was called, and it was a period of hope and prosperity and development. And then what actually started the problems, so to speak, and the rise of what we call modern anti-Semitism has also to do with the conflict between Bismarck as the chancellor and the liberal movement. So the liberal movement split into a national liberal part, which was more nationalistic and went with Bismarck, and leftist liberalism, who was like left more or less alone and became less influential. And this was, in short, bad for the Jews, because it was like the more liberal liberalism, the more leftist liberalism, that had been fighting against the discrimination and so on.
We're talking about the 1870s in Germany. Yeah. So there's this tension and split within the society as to where the discrimination really lay. The more conservative elements of society was more anti-Semitic, that's what you're saying?
Yes, definitely, definitely.
And does that include the churches, the Catholic and Protestant churches?
Of course. This Christian anti-Semitic tradition was maintained in the 19th century, and it was still very influential, but then we have what we call the modern anti-Semitism, which was less based on religion but more on racial theory, and which is a new phenomenon, which became more dominant at that time, in the 1880s. It's an overall phenomenon. It's natural science, the belief in natural science that has to do with illustration, with like religion losing ground as the belief system that explains everything, and we have natural sciences, or the sciences together, becoming very powerful at the end of the 19th century as an explanation for the world. And so in this regard, racism comes up, which has to do, of course, with colonialism, with European colonialism. And it's not only a German phenomenon. You have it everywhere. And within this system of believing that people are racially different, anti-Semitism takes on a new face.
Two very specific things that occurred at the end of the 19th, early 20th century. The Dreyfus Affair in France, then the Russian forgery called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which, as a notion of a Jewish international conspiracy, Hitler picked that up and ran with it.
Yeah, it's interesting that they happen in France and in Russia. So if you would have asked probably someone in Berlin, like a Jewish lawyer or whatever in Berlin, which country he would prefer to live in, which is the less anti-Semitic, he would probably have said Germany, because Russia was very famous for its pogroms, like its violent anti-Semitism. And about the protocols, I think they gained power only after World War One. I mean, it's this lunatic idea really becomes more powerful of the world conspiracy in the 20s. And as for France, it was a big disappointment that a secular state and the French Revolution would, inside its military and inside the state and journalism, would have this anti-Semitic tendency. So actually the Germans, Protestant, Catholic and Jews, felt it's not our story. We are different.
It is almost impossible even now to describe what actually happened in Europe on August 4, 1914. The days before and the days after the First World War are separated not like the end of an old and the beginning of a new period, but like the day before and the day after an explosion. Yet this figure of speech is as inaccurate as are all others, because the quiet of sorrow which settles down after a catastrophe has never come to pass. The first explosion seems to have touched off a chain reaction in which we have been caught ever since, and which nobody seems to be able to stop. Hannah Arendt, The Origins of Totalitarianism, 1951.
This is Encounter on RN, abc.net.au/radio national, and look for Encounter on the program menu. We're talking about anti-Semitism in the period leading up to, during and after World War One, in this 100th anniversary year of the outbreak of the Great War. We're also talking about the influence of the churches in Germany at that time. The Reverend Dr. John Moses.
Germany decided on a program of massive naval expansion of capital ships, which alarmed the British exceedingly, and they tried to negotiate a naval agreement with Germany, which was rejected. And the Kaiser just would not see the danger in all this, and he gave his famous Admiral von Tirpitz all the encouragement he needed to continue with the naval build-up. Now, internally, Germany was a divided nation. By 1912, we have to remember, the largest party in the Reichstag were the Social Democrats, which was a great democratic party. It's like the modern English Labour Party. And they warned against naval expansion and military adventures, as did a small group of pacifists at the time. But the constitution did not allow party control of cabinet. Cabinet was not responsible to the Reichstag or to the lower house, as it is with the Westminster system. They were responsible only to the Kaiser. So they had no influence. And as for anti-Semitism, there was still great discrimination against the Jews. Now, some were leading intellectuals, but these were rarely awarded academic professorships. Jewish business people continued to do well, but a few, despite their wealth, attained social acceptance.
The build-up to war was, although nobody was necessarily actively seeking a war, the build-up of naval forces and the competition with Britain and the expansionist thinking of the Kaiser and the leading elite seemed, in your view, to be inevitably leading towards war. Would you put it as strongly as that?
Yes, pretty much, because it was part of the mental furniture of the German intelligentsia that peace was sort of only the time gap between wars. Warfare was the natural state of mankind. In fact, it was a kind of social Darwinistic mentality. I mean, it derived from Hegel's philosophy, and it was underpinned also by Luther's philosophy of the state, too. It meant that the German idea of God was as a god of battles, not a god of peace. Now, it was, as I said, reinforced by Hegelian philosophy and the teachings of the dominant school of Prussian historians, who at the time argued that if a nation was not expanding, it was dying. And theologians firmly believed, too, that by 1914, Germany's role was to make a bid for world domination. That's because they thought that the British Empire was imploding, if you like. It was losing its control over its colonies. And there's a great deal of writing about this from leading German historians who point out to what extent German decision makers in 1914 were convinced that Almighty God intended Germany to make one Herculean effort to become the world's leading nation. It was a kind of belief in a call by God which they were determined to fulfill. But after the war, when the Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg, in his retirement was interviewed, he wrote that he felt at the time that Germany had to take a leap in the dark. It was an extremely venturesome enterprise, a leap in the dark in going into the First World War. After the war, after the revolution, they had to settle down and try and rewrite the Constitution.
After the war, groups such as the rising Nazi Party blamed the Jews in part or in large part for the defeat and humiliation of the war. Could you comment on that?
The first shock, especially for Jewish men, was in 1916 when the German army command ordered a counting of the Jews in the army and at the front. And we don't know, because this was never published. I mean, there were accusations that the Jews were not fighting as much as the non-Jews and that they were more in the back than in the front. So they ordered a counting and in order to prove or to not prove these accusations. And the results were never published, which of course gave way to speculations. But this feeling of, hey, I'm fighting here, I'm sitting in the trench, risking my life next to my fellow soldiers. And apparently there was less anti-Semitism in the trenches than we would imagine, but many say that there wasn't any. But then with this counting, people were like put into different groups. And I think that was the first big, big shock for German Jewry. And then after the war, there were many like nationalist, anti-Semitic fringe groups, right-wing groups, and it was a time of the German Revolution, so there was a lot of social upheaval. I don't think that it was so clear from the very beginning that it was the Jews who were to blame. The home front was to blame. The home front who had stabbed the dagger into the back of the German army by doing the revolution. So it was the hungry women who made hunger demonstrations, it was the communists and the social democrats, and it was the Jews who were at the same time communists and social democrats. So it was a mixture. It was a big melange of who was to blame. And only slowly, this focus during the 1920s, with the rise of the Nazi Party, but it was much later, in the late 1920s, this focused more and more on the Jews. What we do see as a difference in after the war and the revolution is that we have more violence in the street. And that suddenly we had all these hundred thousands of young men with a very, very important experience of violence during the war, and many of them unemployed. So suddenly violence became a means of politics. And this violence we have throughout the 20s, and it mostly between right-wing and left-wing groups of younger men, but it also extends in some instances to anti-Semitic violence. Of course, it's not only the Nazi Party who's blaming the Jews. It's like anti-Semitism is part of the right-wing parties taken altogether, and it goes far into the former National Liberal Party, the German Volkspartei. But on the other hand, it's interesting to see that the Nazis, after 29, after the world economic crisis, when they wanted to become eligible for the German population, but also for people who gave them money from heavy industry, when they wanted to become a political player and they wanted to become established in a sense, they stopped their heavy anti-Semitic propaganda. I mean, in the last election campaigns, the anti-Semitism is played down, and what is played up is anti-communism, anti-social democrats. So it's not that easy and one-way ticket, so to speak, explanation.
This question of World War One and the 100th anniversary coming up in August, could it be argued that without World War One, the terrible journey through to the Holocaust would have been impossible because there would not have been those extreme experiences of revolution, of conflict, of humiliation, of defeat and despair in Germany? I realise that's putting a hypothetical out there, but how important is World War One because of the way Hitler and the Nazis used the World War One experience?
I think it's even more than that. I think the First World War is, and in German we have the word Urkatastrophe, the founding catastrophe, the basic catastrophe of the 20th century. Of course, as a historian, we are not allowed, I mean, to say this wouldn't have happened if that wouldn't have happened. I mean, this is speculation, but still, the importance of this violent experience, I think, cannot be underrated. And we have very violent right-wing groups popping up everywhere. I mean, we have them in all over Eastern Europe, and we have them in Italy, not to speak of Spain. So it's a general phenomenon, this right-wing violence, and countered, of course, by left-wing violence as well. We shouldn't leave this out. And I think it's more than that, but this is even more speculative because the huge empires break down. I mean, we had the Habsburg Empire and the Ottoman Empire and the Tsarist Empire, which were umbrellas for many different ethnic, language, whatever, religious groups, whatever you want to call them. And we have this suddenly this huge development towards nation states who tend to what they then call ethnic homogeneity or ethnic purity. So we simply do not know what would have happened if these huge empires wouldn't have fallen apart together with this violent experience. And it's all speculative, but yes, I think it's the first and big catastrophe of the 20th century.
The churches, and I assume by which we mean both Catholic and Protestant in Germany, supported the states going to war, supported the theology of strength and might. But when the war was lost, there was not a sense of contrition, remorse, regret, repentance, more of a sense of blaming the enemies of God within the state for the loss. Is that correct?
Yes, pretty much, but also blaming the German working class and the Jews for a stab in the back. And they lost the war not because of the inefficiency of the high command and the navy, but because of undermining going on the home front, strikes and economic profiteering by Jews and so on. So the stab in the back legend was a very powerful instrument or ideology, if you like, picked up by Hitler to advantage because he had scapegoats. He had people he could blame for it. Germany had gone to war for the most honourable objectives, and this had been torpedoed, if you like, by wicked elements on the home front.
The Reverend Dr. John Moses, and before him Professor Stephanie Schuler-Springorum. The causes of World War One and the degree of war guilt which Germany should have assumed after defeat remain debatable, but there was at least one voice in Germany after World War One which refused to participate in the general Christian lament that Germany had lost a war to which God had called the nation. Georg Murnius, a Roman Catholic priest and journalist in Bavaria, took over the editorship in 1929 of an important Catholic weekly journal in Munich called the Allgemeine Rundschau. Murnius was financially supported by Friedrich Förster, who was a German academic and educationalist who, among other things, criticised the political legacy of Bismarck, first during the First World War and then subsequently for the rest of his life. Förster died in 1966. Dr. Greg Munro is lecturer in European history at the Australian Catholic University in Brisbane.
Murnitz, of course, was a strident critique of Hegelian and Prussian power state politics. He saw Prussia's position in Germany as what he called a nonsense and something which was completely unnatural in German history. In particular, he wanted to resuscitate and give new life and confidence to the Catholic worldview. He did not want to in any way accommodate Catholicism to Protestant Prussianism, and saw that the only way for a moral rejuvenation of Germany after 1918 was through a return and a displacement of the ethos of Protestant hegemony through the ethos of Roman Catholicism.
That it would challenge this militaristic symbiosis almost between the state and Protestant thinking.
One must, of course, recognise, particularly in hindsight, that both the goal that Murnius and Förster and their collaborators in Allgemeine Rundschau set them was something that was really beyond the capabilities of a small intellectual movement to achieve. It could only be done if it mobilised large sections of the population. And for a time, Murnius and Förster believed that this may have been possible, particularly through highlighting Germany's war guilt, the insistence on that the German population recognise the German government's guilt for the outbreak of the First World War. They decided to highlight the horrors, if you like, of the First World War by looking at the German invasion of Belgium, neutral Belgium, which was a violation of international law, and the atrocities committed by the German army, both in the first weeks of the war and also during the German occupation of Belgium in the First World War. When Murnius took over the editorship of the Allgemeine Rundschau in January 1929, his strident anti-Prussianism did find some resonance in Catholic Bavaria. Now, this changed when there were four separate issues on the Belgium question of the journal of the Allgemeine Rundschau, published between September 1929 and June 1930. They were very caustic condemnations of Germany's conduct in Belgium. This tended to alienate the vast majority of both Protestants and Catholics. Now, I should add a caveat to that. We know that there were members of the German public who did have reservations, and particularly those who'd fought in the war in Belgium, who knew what Murnius was saying was correct. But to come out and say this publicly in Germany was to risk all sorts of problems such as ostracism and so on. So we know that the Germans, who in their own minds knew that Murnius was correct, but in the atmosphere in Germany in the 1930s, they were not prepared to say so. And just to illustrate this, the Archbishop of Munich, Cardinal Fallhaber, had actually served as a military chaplain in Belgium in the First World War and had witnessed some of these atrocities. And he refused, in spite of the numerous entreaties by various pressure groups in Germany to move against Murnius, he refused up until 1931 to prevent Murnius from discussing the question of Belgium.
Dr. Greg Munro, and my full conversation with him and with all my guests is on our website, abc.net.au/radionational, and follow the program menu to encounter. Returning to our examination of anti-Semitism in Germany before, during and after World War I.
On October 6, 1939, Hitler addresses the German parliament and decrees, among the other aims, that in his third point of resolutions, he would try to resolve the minority group problem in territories now under the swastika. In short, der Führer says he will try to order and regulate the Jewish problem.
Anti-Semitism in Germany takes its most violent form under the Nazis in the 1930s and 1940s. The links backwards and forwards in Germany between the two world wars in relation to anti-Semitism are complex. Professor Mary Fulbrook is Professor of German History, Director of the European Institute and Dean of the Faculty of Social and Historical Sciences at University College London. She's the author of several books on German history, and her recent publication, A Small Town Near Auschwitz, Ordinary Nazis and the Holocaust, forms the basis of our conversation. The small town of the title is Bengen, and the book is largely about Udo Klauser, who was a German bureaucrat. He became the civilian administrator of the town of Bengen in eastern Upper Silesia, which became part of the Third Reich in 1939 after the Nazi invasion of Poland. During the Second World War, Klauser oversaw the ghettoisation, starvation, execution and deportation of most of the large Jewish population in this formerly Polish town. Udo Klauser's wife was Alexandra Klauser. Professor Fulbrook's mother was German-Jewish. Before the Second World War, she was close friends with Alexandra. They were at school together in Berlin. The two families stayed in contact after World War II, but during the Klauser's lifetime, Mary Fulbrook knew nothing of their links with the Nazis during the war. Alexandra was her godmother. Our story for Encounter begins when Mary Fulbrook was shocked to discover quite recently, after the deaths of both her own parents and those of Alexandra and Udo Klauser, that her late godmother's husband must have been a Nazi. Udo Klauser's civilian administrative position in Bengen and all that it entailed had to mean this. Mary Fulbrook met the son of Udo and Alexandra Klauser in Germany recently.
And he is a very charming, very well-educated, very articulate person. And I had dinner with him and I thought, my goodness, I'm a silly person. You know, how on earth could I have been worried about this? Of course, his father did nothing wrong. So I felt very guilty at first to have even questioned this. But then I started getting more and more uneasy as I realised that the son had internalised and absolutely believed all his father's stories. And the more I poked around in archives, the more I realised these stories were not all completely honest, that there were some outright lies and there was some rewriting of the past, reinterpreting facts that couldn't be evaded, but putting them into a different light, and that the son, in a sense, absolutely believed and trusted his father's story, as is quite understandable. The other thing that really, really bothered me throughout the whole process was whether I had any right to challenge the son and the other siblings, their view of their father, who they loved and they respected, whether I should disturb the family myths. On the other hand, I thought, well, if I don't, then I'm complicit in the cover-up.
So you proceeded and wrote this very revealing book. Other detail for you that must have been deeply unsettling was that your mother was of Jewish descent.
Well, my mother was a Christian. She was brought up as a Christian. She did have this German-Jewish family background, which meant that she was the victim, to some extent, of racial discrimination in the early 1930s. She had to leave school very suddenly in April 1933. People repeatedly said to her, you have no future in Germany. This is as a 16, 17, 18-year-old. She knew from the very beginning in 1933. So she got out. I mean, she was very lucky. Alexandra, however, went along with the regime, and my mother and Alexandra did not see eye to eye politically in any way. So they had furious rows after the burning of the books in May 1933, again after Hitler's speech at the Nuremberg Party rally announcing the Nuremberg Laws. They had major rows, but they were emotionally very, very close. This is a really strange relationship, that the friendship seemed more important than the political differences. And so they agreed after a couple of breakups in the early to mid-30s that they would simply not talk politics. My mother was a lifelong socialist, in fact a Quaker in her adult life, and she had quite different views from Alexandra. So they had an emotionally very significant friendship as far as my mother was concerned, but it was at the expense of talking about things that mattered to my mother, to do with religion and politics.
Violence could be exercised entirely unexpectedly, randomly, and from totally unknown quarters. Potential victims were never safe, even when engaged on entirely harmless and permitted pursuits. The testimonies of survivors who gave evidence in the early 1960s are full of examples of brutality. Again and again and again, they report on individual incidents of violence. Miriam Lever, for example, gives a graphic description of a baby being ripped away from its mother's breast, held up by the legs and bashed against the wall, at which point she saw how the skull of the tiny baby shattered and its brains flowed out onto the floor, in full view of its mother. Mary Fulbrook, a small town near Auschwitz, ordinary Nazis and the Holocaust.
anti-Semitism was pan-European, virulent in France in the late 19th, early 20th century. Anti-Semitism was not unique to Germany. There's something different going on in Germany during the Nazi period. I think there are two separate things which are worth distinguishing here. There is this everyday anti-Semitism which characterised Udo and Alexandra and millions of other Germans, which is an assumption that these people are different because of their background, and this became very racialized under Hitler, the whole racist theory of difference. You couldn't even convert out of it. A converted Jew was even more dangerous, an assimilated Jew was even more dangerous because you couldn't recognize them so quickly. So there was this racialization, but the assumption that people are different and inferior was a sort of baseline which meant that you didn't have to have empathy with the victims of policies. You saw yourself as different. Now, what happens with Hitler is, I think, a distinctively new strand develops. It is the takeover of the state by somebody who is violently anti-Semitic to a degree that is far beyond this ordinary everyday anti-Semitism, and who is murderous in intent. And when that is unleashed under specific conditions after the Wall Street crash, Great Depression, collapse of Weimar democracy and so on, and when that is allowed to take over the monopoly of state violence, it becomes something very different from the everyday anti-Semitism of people across Europe. And that's what's significant about the development in Germany. I think the two come together, though, in the war period, because I think without the everyday anti-Semitism of people like Udo and Alexandra and millions of others, the Jews could not have been so easily first excluded from German society and then deported, ghettoised, murdered. The killers come in at the end of that process, but the ordinary anti-Semitism paves the way for that.
Just returning to your point about the trigger of the Wall Street crash, underlying all that, of course, is the humiliation and defeat of World War One. And in what way could one argue that the Holocaust isn't possible without the provocation of the way World War One was handled by the Nazi leadership after World War One? I think the links here need to be examined.
I think you've got to be very careful in the way in which you develop the links here. The humiliation of defeat and the Treaty of Versailles and the loss of territories and status and power and the army and the reparations, all of that bundle after World War One did play a major role in creating the conditions in which anti-Semitism could be fermented, could be developed. And the stab in the back legend, the linking up of Jews and Bolsheviks, the whole threat of Bolshevism, the economic crisis of the early 1920s, all of that was very fertile stamping ground for the development of anti-Semitism. But you cannot argue straight from that to the Holocaust. There are a lot of stages in between. If you look at the mid-1920s, Hitler was nowhere. Roots, seeds of possible economic recovery, possible political stabilisation. It's the Wall Street crash and the Depression that then allow Hitler to come to power. But even then, he is not playing up anti-Semitism as an election propaganda point. So the humiliation defeat in the First World War is clearly very, very important. But you have to take the story slowly and carefully to look at the way in which Hitler downplays anti-Semitism in 1932. It's not a vote winner. And then plays it up very, very significantly in the 1930s in different ways. Again, tones it down at the time of the Olympics in Berlin, doesn't want to be seen badly in the eyes of the world. It's something that he is clearly extremely concerned about. It's very significant for Hitler. But I think the way in which that plays in with other currents, with people's willingness to support, indeed enthusiasm for the Nazi Party, it's not a simple story.
This question of the so-called ordinary Nazi, the German person in an administrative role, or the person even witnessing in their own local community. For instance, the Jewish ghetto of Bedgen, the town where Udo Klasse was the governor, the terrible hunger, the deprivation of food for the Jewish community, then the shocking murderous punishment if members of that community tried to get out and find food. It's hard to see how that is only a policy implementation. There seems to be so much more ingrained underneath that.
I think that's absolutely right. Even within Germany in the 1930s, not noticing that Jews were not around anymore, this is a creeping formation of two very different communities, the community with whom you have empathy and those that you don't care about anymore, that you don't see. They just disappear from German society through the 1930s. Then when you get to this period of the war, there is this accumulation of issues on the ground at the same time as the development of policy from above. If you say, we want Jews out of the better houses because the Germans want to take them over, if you say, we will concentrate Jews into ever smaller areas, which is effectively the first stage of ghettoisation, so that we can keep better control of them, so that we can march them to their work, their forced labour gangs, their slave labour camps, so that we can control them. They do not deserve to eat as much. If there is going to be rationing, we will cut their rations, cut their rations, cut their rations. Tough if they die, tough if they get ill, tough if they're beaten up brutally, even shot to death for having tried to get around these measures. That's going on at a very widespread level, and it is, on some views, creating a cumulative picture in which Jews become ever more of a real and not a metaphorical problem, again in quotation marks. In other words, disease is spreading, typhus is spreading, epidemics are spreading, and this is endangering the local Germans. However much you ghettoise Jews, the disease can get across the ghetto boundaries more easily than the Jews can. And so there is a growing will to find a what was called a final solution to the Jewish problem, rather than these interim, let's move them out of this area, let's move them out of that, let's make this area Jew-free, cleansed of Jews in the Nazi jargon.
Zosia Beigelmann had gone to the selections with her uncle and some other members of her family. At the time she was only 14 years old. In her interview, she recalled, with tears, how a lot of people were separated from their children. Like cattle, we stopped being human. Mary Fulbrook, a small town near Auschwitz, ordinary Nazis and the Holocaust.
There's another link between the First World War and the Second World War, and that's the army and the traditional conservative nationalists who saw Hitler as someone that they could use in making Germany great again, in getting over the humiliation of the Versailles Treaty. And they are the conservative nationalist elites who work with Hitler through the 30s, who think they can use Hitler, and then find they are being used by him. And when you look at some of these people, they are not rabidly, murderously, genocidally anti-Semitic. They simply assume that Germans are superior. They are low-level anti-Semites. They are seeing Hitler as the path to victory for Germany, and Hitler is using them as part, or trying to use them, not merely as returning Germany to military and political greatness, but also to creating a Jew-free German empire. So there is a combination of different priorities coming together here, which is what makes it so potent and so evil. And that conservative nationalist strand is what allows people after the war, the elites, to say, oh, I was not really a Nazi, I was a conservative nationalist, and I didn't know that it was going to lead to all that. There are these distinctions still, and they do come together in the Second World War.
Mary Fulbrook, Professor of German History at University College London. One outspoken critic of Hitler and the Nazis in the 1920s and 1930s was the Bavarian Catholic priest and journalist Georg Mernius. He and the regular contributors to the journal of the Allgemeine Rundschau are not as well known as some who resisted the Nazi regime, but they were nonetheless significant. Dr. Greg Munro again.
Mernius was, as one can imagine, a particularly fanatical opponent of National Socialism as a movement, and in particular of Hitler as the leader of the National Socialist movement. He described Hitler and the Nazi movement as representing a barbaric set of forces derived from 19th century social Darwinist views, from German intellectual life, social Darwinist views which were particularly predominant in southern Germany and Austria, and also incorporating a vengeful Prussianism which wanted to reassert its position first in Germany and then subsequently once again in Europe. And indeed, he used every means to lampoon the movement for its very second-rate, third-rate intellectual status, and presented it as not, if you like, as a carrier of German nationalism, but as an extremely dire threat to Germany. And his concentration on Hitler and National Socialism was so strong that a lot of the citizens of Munich referred to what they called a Murnermania because of his constant warnings about the destructive potential of the National Socialists should they continue their ascendancy in Bavaria.
How did the Nazis respond to Murnius?
Murnius was indeed an exception in terms of Catholic culture, in his constant emphasis on German guilt for the First World War, his constant critique of the National Socialists. Now, the Nazi Party, from particularly after the Reichstag elections of September 1930, when they dramatically increased their mandate in the Reichstag, now attempted to present themselves as the protectors, as the foremost advance guard of German interests, of German nationalism in what was becoming a increasingly destabilised or crisis-ridden Germany. And the Nazis actually took advantage of Murnius and the failure of the Catholic authorities to decisively act against him. And they said that Murnius was indeed a typical characteristic of the culture of Catholicism of the Centre Party, and used this very effectively to intimidate German political Catholicism in the Weimar Republic with great effect, so that Murnius increasingly became a major embarrassment for the Centre Party in Germany and for a wide range of people within the German Catholic Church.
Dr. Greg Munro. Georg Murnius escaped from Munich in March 1933 and went into exile in the United States. Professor Mary Fulbrook again. Can we speak about any distinctions between ordinary Nazis and the horrendous intentions of the few which led to the final solution? Has one got to get to the stage where those distinctions collapse, or are they still sustainable?
I think the distinctions are sustainable, but I think what is significant about Udo Clauser and those like him, he's very typical. He's not, I don't want to make him stand as if he's an individual on his own. I think what the distinction is the following. Those who knew they were constructing gas chambers and perfecting techniques of murdering people in ever greater numbers, ever more efficiently, were purposefully engaging in a murderous enterprise. Those who were administrating the conditions in which this became possible were able to kid themselves that because all they were doing were moving Jews from one place to another or cutting their rations, that they didn't need to be responsible for the consequences. And I think that the wider moral lesson to be learned from this is that you cannot play your role as a cog in a bureaucratic machine putting policies into practice without thinking, what are the wider conditions in which I'm doing this? What are going to be the consequences for those affected by my policies? And Clauser and millions like him should have got out of their jobs or not pursued that career from 33 onwards, when it was clear to my mother as a 16-year-old that this regime was criminally wrong. Other people were pursuing their careers and trying to make a career knowing that Hitler was somebody who thought murder was a legitimate political weapon. I think there's a distinction, but it's important not to exonerate those who are the desk people.
Mary Fulbrook, Professor of German History at University College London and the author of A Small Town Near Auschwitz, Ordinary Nazis and the Holocaust. Stephanie Schuler-Springorum is the director of the Institute for Research on Antisemitism at the Technical University in Berlin.
But I really do believe in democracy and human rights, and I think we have legal means to fight certain things. We have this typical situation, let's say, in a provincial village, little town, there's like a strong young right-wing gang who are smearing swastikas on the walls, and then maybe the policeman who knows who's the cousin of the father of someone, maybe he would not go as strictly against it as he should. But the basic and the difference is we have legal means to fight it. We have a civil society which is concerned. And we have a process which is also important, I think, of European integration and unification, which I think is basically also something that, with all the difficulties, of course, is a hopeful process.
This is a key leadership role now, 100 years after the outbreak of World War One, is it not?
It is, but of course we have to keep a low profile, I would say, because I can only speak for the field that I'm working in, which is, among others, also Holocaust and Holocaust remembrance. There's a certain tendency of saying, hey, we have the best commemoration museums and places, and we have the best education programs on Holocaust education, etc. So now we want to export all this, especially to Eastern Europe. And one has to be very careful, given the German history and all this. So I think each country has to have its own process, and in many countries it will still take a while. I mean, now that I'm so positive about German democracy, I mean, it took us 70 years to get here. One must not forget the 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s when no one would want to talk about it, or hardly, and when there was no restitution, and when the victims were not being heard or listened to and were not giving a public stage or frame of resonance. So, I mean, it took us some decades to get to the point where we are now, and one shouldn't forget this.
In Judaism, you might define as inventing historical time. Historical time in respect to that it has a beginning and a future. Holy time does not have a beginning and a future. It's a circular type. It's actually, holy time recalls all the time the creation of the world. So it's not something that has a beginning and an end. And you might say the holidays are reminding us of that sacred creation of the world, but you include the historical knowledge in the sacred time. So in Judaism, there is no clear division between sacred, holy, and secular. And that is actually the fascinating thing in our exhibition, that you see in every holiday, you recall a historical event.
That was Seelie Kugelmann, Vice Director of the Jewish Museum in Berlin, speaking of their recent exhibition, A Time for Everything, Rituals Against Forgetting. Recordings at the museum by Joanne Vellen. This is Encounter on rnabc.net.au/radionational, and look for Encounter on the program menu. You can hear the program again, download it, and listen to the full conversations with my guests. We've been tracing something of the history of anti-Semitism in Germany before, during and after World War One. I've called the program The Founding Catastrophe. Thanks to ABC Radio Archives. Mary Fulbrook's book, A Small Town Near Auschwitz, Ordinary Nazis and the Holocaust, is published by Oxford University Press, 2012. John Moses' book, Reluctant Revolutionary, Dietrich Bonhoeffer's Collision with Prusso-German History, is published by Berghahn Books, 2009. Greg Munro's book, Hitler's Bavarian Antagonist, Georg Mernius and the Allgemeine Rundschau of Munich, 1929-1933, is published by the Edwin Mellon Press, 2006. Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism is published by George Allen and Unwin, 1951. The reader was Eugene Gilfeder. Music by Arnold Schoenberg. Technical production, Peter McMurray and James Usher. I'm Florence Sperling.
Next week on Encounter, two stories of interreligious conflict. One from Nigeria, where the long-standing tension between Christians and Muslims has resulted in terrible violence and in the determination from some communities to achieve peace. And one from Burma, where the bumpy transition to democracy is resulting in clashes between Muslims and Buddhists. That's Encounter, Saturday after the news at 5, so join us then. And for the rest of this evening here on RN, we have Away coming up after the news and the Best of World Radio a little later in the evening. I'm David Rutledge.
In the social media age, we take, alter, crop and share photos like never before. And we use them as badges, symbols of who we are and how we feel. But while the photograph has always been more than just a captured image, in the modern era, is it becoming more message than memory? Photos, social media and memory on Future Tense. Download the program from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.